couple of words of explanation. Now, Mr. Gacciani is visiting Australia at the invitation of the Foundation for Economic Education, OST in brackets, which is affiliated with the Foundation for Education in the USA. He's spending 5 weeks here and visiting most of the mining areas, and he's really this weekend in transit from Perth to Kalgoorlie. At the age of 17, Mr. Gacciani left his native Italy with $5 in his pocket. He knows the meaning of hard work because in his spare time he achieved a degree in chemical engineering from the New York University, and since that time he's achieved many academic distinctions in several fields. He is the editor of Mining Engineering magazine, which is the official journal of the American Society of Mining Engineers. He has written and edited hundreds of articles on many subjects that I think were enumerated in Thursday's Christmas Express. He's also a director of the Committee for Monetary Research and Education, a non-profit organisation in the USA, which has on its board a lot of well-known economists. He is the engineer who predicted the energy crisis some time before it actually happened, and whilst other people predicted the same energy crisis, he has the I was almost going to say unique responsibility, but you will probably be more modest and say that other people too also foresaw why it would happen and exactly when it would happen, which is what he did. Tonight he's speaking on the subject of the environment, and I would say that Mr. Gacciani is a real environmentalist. His concern is mainly for people, and in particular the rights of the individual. So, Mr. Eugene Gacciani.
Ladies and gentlemen, I just finished dinner, and I am allergic to alcohol, which is not too bad coming from Salt Lake City, Utah, where I have lived for the past 2.5 years. As you know, Utah is a Mormon country, and Mormons are rather uptight about cigarettes and about liquor. Well, one out of two isn't too bad. Apropos of this, I was going to tell Grant tonight the story, but I'll tell you, so you also get the benefit of it. There was a dinner in New York at which Winston Churchill was the honored guest, and he was sitting right next to a Mormon bishop. Now, why I'm saying this is because I have to sit down because, allergic as I am to alcohol, I don't think I am steady on my feet. I had 2 glasses of wine. Well, maybe 2.5. Anyhow, Winston Churchill was sitting right next to this Mormon bishop, and Winnie loved to drink. And of course, they were serving French wines, and Winnie kept gossiping that down, and the Mormon bishop was getting more and more uptight. And then at the end of dinner, the waiter came over with a big box of Havana cigars, and of course, Winston Churchill grabbed a handful of them. When they finally passed the box in front of the Mormon bishop, he said that the bishop said that he would rather commit adultery than partake of alcoholic beverage or tobacco, at which point Winston Churchill called back the waiter and said, "Waiter, I'm returning my cigars because I didn't know that I had a choice on that." So I have a choice of either sitting down or standing up, so I'm sitting down. Talking about the environment, environmental pollution, I think it's best to define our terms to begin with. Pollution is the result of either waste energy or waste matter, be it liquid, gaseous, or solid, that at the existing level of knowledge cannot be converted into a value, and that when present beyond a particular threshold level becomes harmful to a man's life or fouls up his property. So immediately, the fundamental involved in pollution is the question of rights, the individual's right to his own life and to his own property. Now, what pollution means in practical terms is that if the polluting waste can be converted into a value, then the problem ends there. It becomes a technical, a routine sort of assignment to discharge. If, however, the waste cannot be converted into a value, then what we can do, rationally and honestly, is to try to get the law, the judicial venture government, to think of pollution as a violation of individual rights. To do that does not require, as we have in the United States, an environmental protection agency with a budget of about $4,500 to $5,000 a year and 10,000 bureaucrats. It merely requires of the judiciary the proper application of the tort laws of nuisance, trespass, and negligence. To give an example, if somebody dumps garbage in your front lawn, then there is no question of who has violated your rights, and the law makes provision for compensation. The same principle holds if somebody fouls up the air you breathe or your property. Of course, it's very difficult to assess what is an individual's right to such abstract things as air and water. When it comes to land, the issue is a simpler. However, by and large, the definition of an individual's right to land, air, and water is very difficult. However, it is not impossible to solve. That is a problem for the judiciary to tackle. If this very difficult question of rights had been phrased within the context of individual rights since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we would not be today in the sort of chaotic mess that we are in, where technology actually lags behind the type of regulatory cleanup that the bureaucrats require of us. So the question is, why weren't these legal and medical questions? Legal questions in terms of what are an individual's right to land, air, and water, and the medical questions, at what point does pollution actually become a harm to oneself? Why weren't these questions phrased within the context of individual rights? And how did we wind up in the present state of Orwellian type of regulation? And the answer is very important, because it has really nothing to do with science or engineering or jurisprudence. It has to do with ideology, specifically with the ideology of collectivism. The catchphrase, the slogan of all collectivists, be they collectivists of the left or collectivists of the right, is the public interest, the common good. It is never the rights of actual flesh and blood people. In fact, under collectivism, which parenthetically is the basis of socialism, the individual is nothing, the collective or the state is everything. Under socialism, individual rights are not recognized as inalienable rights, but they are considered as revocable rights. Revocable rights by the state of an omniscient, omnipotent state that is totally biased against any kind of private ownership of the means of production. So the current regulatory chaos of anti-pollution legislation, this mess that we have, is in itself an indictment and a consequence of collectivism, because of its emphasis on communal or public property of land, air, and water. To give an example, in the latter part of the 19th century in the United States, when the consequences of air pollution were far worse than they are today, the courts invariably held in favor of polluters and denied the suits of victims of pollution on the grounds that the need of society for factories was more important than the individual's right to his own property.
Water pollution was similarly ignored on the grounds that nobody owned the river except the community, whose interest the state assumed to be the need of society for the factories and not the right of the individual who owned the riverfront property which was being polluted from the people upstream. This is by way of background about the good old days of the 19th century and the early 20th century. Going now to more recent times, more specifically to the late 1960s and to the early 70s, when every demagogue, every vote-seeking politician, every industry hater, in those days everybody of that type was calling himself an environmentalist. The only thing was that all of those people always had and still have a very powerful axe to grind against capitalism. So the pollution problems were just a marvelous platform from which to launch one last attack against what's left of free enterprise in America. However, before they would launch that attack, they had to convert those problems into a crisis. Now, how do you convert a problem into a crisis? It's very simple. What you do is to give that problem to solve to Washington or to Canberra, and then the problem, no matter how small, you can be sure it will soon blossom into a crisis. Today, after about 10 years of monumental distortions, the truth is beginning to emerge. In the first place, air quality measurements indicate that the air in both rural and urban centers is far cleaner than it was during the Great Depression, when industrial activity was at a very low level. That's a fact. It was a fact long before the Environmental Protection Agency was created by the Nixon administration. Next, the amount of land that has ever been disturbed by all types of surface mining activity, this is when you dig a hole in the ground, not when you go underground. Surface mining is a synonym, incidentally, of strip mining. In other words, you are removing the surface and then you get to the exposed ore body. Okay, the amount of land that has ever been disturbed in the United States by all types of surface mining is 0.16% of the total surface of the United States. Now, half of that 0.16% has already been reclaimed. The West is in the process of reclamation. That's a fact, incidentally, put out by the U.S. government itself. Next, you might be glad to know that Lake Erie, in the Great Lakes region of the United States, is quite alive and well, and so are the oceans. That's another fact. Finally, all medical evidence, plus the latest life expectancy figures, show that Americans are healthy and getting healthier, that the infant mortality rate is now at the lowest level in the history of the United States, and that of the remaining major health problems, things like diabetes, heart disease, obesity, venereal disease, car accidents, mental illness, and many forms of cancer, none of these things are either population-related or pollution-related, but rather are caused from lifestyle habits and hereditary factors. Now, these are medical facts. Now, in view of all of these facts, you would think that the environmentalists would be happy, but the fact is that they are not. And I suggest that the reason why environmentalists are unhappy about this good news is that they don't give a damn either about the environment or about any improvement in the human condition. Until about a year ago or so, I would have hesitated to say what I'm saying tonight with full certainty. You see, the leaders of the environmental movement not the millions of followers, just the leaders. Until some time ago, were closet socialists in America. They have now come out of the closet, and they have identified themselves as avowed, dedicated socialists. And they have made no mystery of the fact that what they want is to eliminate what's left of free enterprise in America. I don't want you to take my word for it. I want you to hear it directly from their lips. And I'm going to quote now from a book called The Environmental Handbook, which is considered by the ecologists as their Bible. It was first published in 1970. It's available in soft cover for about $1.95. The publisher is Ballantine Books in New York City. In the preface of this book, the editor, Mr. Garrett Nobel, who is a biologist from Stanford University, states, and I quote, "Our intention is not to praise the country's industrial arrogance, but to put a stop to it," end quote. Immediately after, Mr. DeBell tells us what he means by the country's industrial arrogance. And he has a very long list, at the top of which he puts, quote-unquote, those ugly power plants. Then follows the rest. Automobiles, air conditioners, clothes dryers, clothes washers, canned foods, single-family houses, tranquilizers, hairsprays, deodorants, artificial sweeteners such as calcium cyclamate, monosodium glutamate, in other words, the kind of products that are made by the same industries that have been vilified and attacked for the past 10 years, and that, incidentally, are the same products that virtually anyone in the United States can afford, but that only the elite is permitted to buy or can afford to buy in special stores in Moscow, Pekin, Havana, or other Marxist capitals. Still quoting from the Environmental Handbook, here's what Dr. René Dubose, professor of microbiology at Rockefeller University in New York City, has to say about American City, and I quote, "American cities give the impression of being more crowded than Asian and European cities, not because their population density is greater, it is in fact much lower, but because they expose their inhabitants to many more unwelcome stimuli. Much of the experience of crowding comes not from contacts with real human beings, but from telephones, radios, and television sets that bring us the mechanical expressions of mankind instead of the warmth of its biological nature," end quote. Now, if Dr. Dubois doesn't get turned on by the TV sets, radios, automobiles, and telephones in American cities, he is the kind of fellow, I'm sure, would feel very much at ease in an Asian city such as Calcutta, where he would get lots and lots of exposure to the warmth, not to mention the smell, of mankind's biological nature. All of these people, Garrett Nobel, René Dubose, and some others that I shall mention, go to extra pains to explain that what they want is not classical socialism or classical communism. What they want is something else, and we'll find out what it is. For the moment, here is what Mr. Keith Lange, another author, co-author of the Environmental Handbook, has to say on the subject. Quote, "Capitalism phased out cannot be replaced with socialism or communism because these forms also are growth and progress oriented." End quote. What Mr. Lange advocates is that, and I quote again, "Capitalism must be phased out and replaced with cooperative economic models," end quote. Now, as to what ought to be the primary method to phase out capitalism, Dr. Garrett Hardin, professor of biology at the University of California in Santa Barbara, has the answer, and he doesn't pull any punches. He's another author of the Environmental Handbook. Dr. Hardin advocates violence, coercion, force. I quote, "Coercion is a dirty word to most liberals right now, but it need not forever be so. as with the fall out of words, its dirtiness can be cleansed away by exposure to the light, by saying it over and over without apology or embarrassment. To many people, the word coercion implies arbitrary decisions of bureaucrats, but this is not a necessary part of its meaning. The only coercion I recommend is mutual coercion, mutually agreed upon by the majority of the people affected. I'll repeat that last sentence by Hardin. The only coercion I recommend is mutual coercion, mutually agreed upon by the majority of the people affected. So, there it is. In Dr. Garvin's own words, the type of thing that we are up against. I doubt that there are people in this room that would either submit or advocate coercion or violence. Now, what would Professor Hardin do if he came to a position of power? I leave that up to you to judge. Again, remember what Garrett Lavelle, the editor of this book, said in the preface. Our intention is not to praise the country's present industrial arrogance, but to put a stop to it. Now the question is, how are you going to put a stop to the industry of America? The gentleman who answers that question is none other than Mr. John W. Gardner. You might not know who he is. Well, I'll tell you. He is a good, upstanding citizen of the United States. He is a member in good standing of the Republican Party. He is the former chairman of the Urban Coalition Action Council. He was former secretary of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare during the Lyndon Johnson administration. And he is currently the $100,000 per year chairman of Common Cause, which is a Washington pressure group. The Honorable John Gardner tells us that in order to put a stop to the country's industrial arrogance, quote, one thing a citizen can do is to throw the weight of public opinion against those in the private sector who are unwilling to work toward the solution of our common problems, end quote. Now, Gardner acknowledges that that may not be enough because he says, and I quote, an important thing to understand about any institution or social system, it doesn't move unless you give it a solid push, not a mild push, a solid joint, end quote. Now, against what should you aim this very solid joint? The Honorable John Gardner answers, against our system of checks and balances. I don't know how familiar you are with the American system of government, but it is based on the separation of the executive, judiciary, and legislative branches of government, so that no one branch of government can acquire dictatorial or totalitarian powers over the others, and then presumably over the rest of the citizens. Going back to Mr. Gardner, quote, our system of checks and balances dilutes the thrust of positive action. The competition of interests inherent in our pluralism acts as a brake on concerted action, end quote. Now, the kind of jolt that the Honorable John Gardner refers to is something that everybody in the mining industry is familiar with, at least in the mining industry in the United States, and that is the environmental impact statement, which is part and parcel of the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, which was passed thanks to the lobbying effort of the Honorable John Gardner and other so-called environmentalists. Before 1969, before this National Environmental Policy Act was passed, ecologists could not sue the government. For instance, they could not sue the Department of the Interior in order to stop it from issuing a federal lease or granting permission to build a pipeline through federal lands. Since they could not allege damage to themselves, they had no standing in court. Their suits would be thrown out. However, after the National Environmental Policy Act was passed, anybody, an Arab agent, even a Russian agent, by merely posting a $100 bond could bring to a grinding halt and stop a federal agency from issuing operating licenses, leases, building permits. All that the plaintiff has to do in a case like that is to allege that the agency, the company in question, did not file an adequate environmental impact statement. Now, the damage that the National Environmental Policy Act has done in America is incalculable to the economic life of the nation. However, economies have a way of going up and down. I'm talking about the damage that the disastrous bill has done to the system of checks and balances in the United States. Because that is really irreparable, because you have to consider, in this regard, a number of implications of that particular law. Among other things, that law asks you to prove that your future activity will not harm the environment. In the first place, to ask you to give proof of a negative is to make shambles on reason and logic, because proof requires the evidence of an existent. You cannot give proof of that which doesn't exist. No evidence is possible about a negative. In the second place, to ask you to submit your plans to the verdict of a bureaucracy, such as the Environmental Protection Agency, and I think you in Australia might have such an agency one of these days, to ask to submit your plans to such an agency, which acts as policeman, legislator, judge, jury, and prosecuting attorney, is to circumvent the separation of powers which are mandated by the Constitution of the United States. In the third place, to treat your intended future activity as suspect is equivalent to considering you as guilty until you prove yourself innocent in a situation where there is no question of a crime ever having been committed. Now, this is disruptive of justice. Finally, to ask you, in effect, to be omniscient about all the consequences of an activity that hasn't yet taken place is to wipe out your integrity by forcing you to guess in matters of science. Now, to launch such an attack against reason, against logic, against justice, against integrity, against science, by means of one single concept of the environmental impact statement, is certainly a very solid jolt, and a very deadly accurate one, not only against the economy of the most prosperous nation on earth, but also against its philosophical and constitutional foundations. The attempt to destroy all of these values by means of one single concept, this is not the attempt of misguided idealists. This is the attempt of academic thugs and intellectual bandits whose real purpose is to gain power over all of us in America. I would like now to point out another achievement of the so-called environmentalists. And this is the massive amount of land withdrawals from mineral exploration. You see, in 1872, the Congress of the United States passed the Mineral Mining Act. Since in the United States at the time was a poorly populated country, pretty much like Australia today, a great deal of land, especially west of the Mississippi, was public land, publicly owned. It was federal land. From 1968 until today, 73% of that federal land has been withdrawn from the Minerals Act of 1872. Now, the situation is analogous to, let's say, your government telling your doctor that from now on, he may not look for symptoms of disease in 73% of your body. In other words, that he must only examine you from the top of your chest, the top of your head. What's involved in exploration? you're actually doing anything. You're just looking around, nothing else. Looking for geological evidence of what exists in the subsoil. Now, how were the environmentalists able to withdraw so many millions of acres from the Mining Act of 1872? They did that by all sorts of land use bills, which I think is one of the things that's coming up in Australia. Now, the kind of land use legislation that has been proposed and or passed in a great many of the state legislatures in America is totally unnecessary within the context of about 800 years of Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence, which tells you that property is what you own, and that gives you the right to use and dispose as you see fit, provided that in doing so, you don't infringe the right of some other citizen by way of negligence, trespass, nuisance, force, or fraud. Actually, you see, the real purpose of land use legislation is to place at the discretion of bureaucrats the use and disposal of your property, which will no longer be yours by right, but by permission. And this is what land use legislation actually does. It does something infinitely better than expropriation, because it leaves upon you the burdens of ownership, which means property taxes, school taxes, assessments, insurance, maintenance. But it takes away from you your right of use and disposal whenever some bureaucrat in Washington or in Canberra claims that he needs your land more than you do. Also, you have to observe how adroitly all the socialists have been in pushing forward the concept of public property. The argument usually begins by saying that all of these millions of acres of federal land must be dedicated to wildlife, to ecological sanctuaries. And the fact is that today in the United States you have more wildlife sanctuaries than you know what to do with it. They say that this land should not be made available to the multiple use of individuals and industries, and that it should remain forever locked in as public property. Now, I submit to you that the concept of public property is a contradiction in terms. Break it down in its components. First of all, what the hell is the public? The public is everybody in general and nobody in particular. As to the concept of property, property, long before it became a legal concept, was a scientific concept. The concept of property scientifically identifies the relationship that exists between the attributes of a particular entity. For instance, this ashtray has a particular density, which is the ratio of its weight to its volume. You cannot physically remove density from this ashtray without disintegrating it. Okay. Now, on moral legal grounds, the concept of property identifies the relationship that exists between a man and a value, and the law in most civilized countries clearly specifies the proper method in which a man acquires title and possession of a particular object. To repeat, the concept of public property is a contradiction in terms. Even in science, we don't have such a thing as a public or collective property of the elements, or a collective density of liquids, or a collective molecular weight of substances. In the past few months in the United States, and I've seen some evidence of it here in Australia reading the papers, but I'm talking now about the United States, there has been a very disturbing development, and this is the alliance, the convergence between the labor movement and the environmental movement. And there was an article published on this alliance. It appeared in the New York Times on May the 4th this year. It described how Leonard Woodcock, who is president of the United Automobile Workers, and Dr. Barry Conner, who is an ecologist at Washington University, organized a 5-day national meeting in Black Lake, Michigan, for 300 union leaders and ecology activists. Now, the only conflict between labor leaders and ecology leaders is on tactics. But they all agree on a common goal. They all agree on their ultimate strategy. The ideology of the environmental leaders is as socialistic as that of the labor leaders. Quote, "We don't see eye to eye with the environmental community in its opposition to nuclear power," said Mr. Woodcock. "On the other hand, we thoroughly supported legislation to regulate surface mining," end quote. Still quoting Mr. Woodcock, he also said at this meeting, quote, "We haven't agreed with them on banning non-returnable containers, but we are with them in seeking national land use legislation." Then Dr. Connor, the ecologist, suggested at the joint meeting that what was needed was a reorientation in the economy of the United States. And he said, and I quote, "We face a big debate on how we are going to devote resources for the common good rather than for profit. There is a whole question of inventing a new form of socialism," end quote. Now, I'll tell you the kind of new form of socialism that Barry Commoner wants to introduce. I happen to have been born and raised in it. But I'll give you a tip. It consists of preserving the illusion of private ownership, but with the control entirely in the hands of the state. The state, which in turn will be under the control of a wise and benevolent elite composed by the likes of Leonard Woodcock and Barry Commoner. Turning now a little to an analysis of the labor movement, not only in the United States, but worldwide, labor leaders all over have made no secret of their anti-capitalistic and pro-socialist bias. Let's see why. It may help in understanding the strange alliance with the ecologists. You see, from the beginning of recorded history up to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, wealth was accumulated by military conquest, by plunder, by theft, and by physical labor, which usually meant by slave labor. Well, the Industrial Revolution, along with the American Revolution, put an end to most of that. Because, you see, it was then possible to generate wealth by productive labor, by productive ability, and by the uncoerced exchange of values among free men. The tragedy was that the European intellectuals of that time never fully grasped or appreciated the importance of the American Revolution or of the Industrial Revolution. With a few exceptions, particularly Adam Smith and John Locke, most European philosophers limited themselves to observing what was happening in their societies, which were just as feudalistic and as totalitarian as all of the other societies that had existed prior to the 19th century, the 18th century. So, they looked back in history, they observed that wealth was always the result of some sort of gigantic rip-off scheme or another of slave labor, and they reached the brilliant conclusion that what was now needed was a massive redistribution of wealth. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Well, anyhow, this theme was picked up by Karl Marx, who in his more sane moments I have a great admiration for, because he came to the brilliant conclusion that if certain things were done, then government would fade away, and we all would live free of all this burden of taxation that we have. Well, it's a nice talk, except that he was miserably wrong in virtually every other observation he made. Anyhow, it was through this kind of nonsense that throughout the 19th century, every successful businessman was attacked as being a robber baron who cruelly exploited the poor and who amassed obscene wealth at the expense of society. Now, I'm going to read to you what Milton Friedman says about this subject. It is particularly pertinent to you as Australians and to us as Americans because both our countries were populated by immigrants. I quote from Milton Friedman. It refers to the 19th century. Far from being a period in which the poor were being ground under the heels of the rich, exploited unmercifully and the like, there is probably no period in human history in this or any other country in which the ordinary simple man had as large an increase in his standard of living as in the period between the Civil War and the First World War, the period when unrestrained individualism was most rugged. The evidence of this is to be found not only in the statistics that economists have constructed of what was happening to national income, but is documented in a much more dramatic way by the numbers of people who came to the United States during that period. That was a period, incidentally, when we had unrestricted immigration. Continuing with Friedman's quote, did people come to the United States to be ground under the heels of merciless capitalists? Did they come to the United States to make their own condition worse? There is no more dramatic way, says Friedman, in which people can vote than with their feet. Of course, our present condition in America is far better than theirs. In an absolute sense, their level of living was low, but we must compare their level of living not to ours, but to the level of living that they left in Europe. End quote. Okay. The labor movement has been extremely successful in pushing forth the redistribution of wealth argument, often achieving the bankruptcy of various nations in the process, and I give you as an example Argentina and Great Britain as the prime examples. And they've been able to do this thanks to the strong arm tactics and the monopolistic powers granted by or extorted from government. Labor leaders in the United States, however, have not been quite as successful in sustaining the superstition of a class warfare between labor and management. They have been unable to do that in the United States, if nothing else because in the U.S. the standard of living of the average man that you pick at random is still the highest, among the highest on earth. There's a friend of mine, his name is Sylvester Petrov, he is director of the Institute for Labor Policy Analysis in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. At a lecture at Columbia University, he pointed out that labor leaders, by necessity, must keep alive the destructive myth of class warfare. Why? Because the day that the rank and file members discover the obvious truth that employees and employers share the strongest bonds of mutual self-interest ever known to mankind, says Sylvester Petrov, on that day, the party will be over for labor leaders. When that day comes, sure, the big union leaders will continue to exist, but they will very soon lose all the glory, power, opulence, and political influence that they now enjoy. After all, you see, the free market gives its rewards to producers, not to parasites. It is not surprising in this context that the strategy of union leaders is to keep on discrediting and undercutting the business community and to perpetuate the myth and superstition of a class warfare by constantly attacking and ridiculing any remnants of free enterprise in the United States or in any